Hello and welcome back to The Anecdotalist, episode 16. I'm your host, Paul Packard, and with me as always, my co-host, Jason McKinney.
Hello, everybody.
Tonight we're covering the disappearance of the Flannan Isle Lighthouse Keepers. Not to be confused with the Smalls Lighthouse story, the one where we get William Dafoe, that meme of him looking up into the sky. That would be a fun episode to cover. That's not tonight. We're talking about the mysterious disappearance of three men, James Duquette, Thomas Marshall, and Donald MacArthur.
Oh, this sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it is. I'm excited to go through it tonight. But first, I do want to mention one quick thing. If you listen to our Ghost of the Ohio State Reformatory episode, two episodes back, stick around for some bonus content at the end of this episode. I went this past weekend to the Shawshank 30th anniversary and had a blast. It was awesome walking through that prison. And we're going to talk about that here after the theme music plays at the end of the episode, so stick around for that. That said, Jason, are you ready?
I am, man, and I am so excited to hear another unsolved mystery. Let's solve a case.
Okay, here we go. December 26th, 1900, Flannan Isles, the UK. The waves crashed against the rocks where the lighthouse stood. Captain Jim Harvey of the ship Hesperus launches a flare and blares his horn, hoping to alert the lighthouse keepers to his arrival. But no sign of life comes from the lighthouse. The flagpole bore no flag. Joseph Moore, the relief keeper, stepped onto the rocks below and began climbing the steep staircase to the lighthouse above. The clock on the wall stopped, and a table plated for dinner, still sitting uneaten, but no sign of the three men that kept the lighthouse.
Okay, so the clock on the wall stopped. This makes me think of like UFO again.
It's the aliens. Yeah, I know. I that was my first thought too. I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. It's just because they unwound. So you have to wind. Obviously, you wind clocks. They just had been absent for so long that all the clocks had unwound themselves, essentially.
Oh, I'm telling you, man, I love your cold openings because the end of that, it was like I could picture it.
Yeah, I know. It's spooky. Okay, so what we have here is a classic disappearing person's mystery. The problem is the lighthouse was so remote and the evidence so bare that we really don't know what happened. Tonight, what we plan to do is cover the timeline and trace the steps of what we do know. We'll then cover the investigation, which kind of blends in with the timeline since all the information we basically have comes from the discovery and subsequent search and investigation of what happened. We'll get into theories of what took place, and finally, we'll discuss our own opinions on what we think may have happened here.
Yeah, man, this is why you don't be a lighthouse keeper. Things are going to happen. You're out in the middle of nowhere. You're living in a lighthouse. Obviously, stuff's going to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens at lighthouses back in this period before they were automated. Yeah, it's not great. It reminds me of the Moonville Tunnel episode we did. I think episode like 2 before they automated the railway there. And you always had accidents. When a person has to be in a remote location dealing with, in this case, mostly weather as opposed to like mechanics with a train, nothing ever good happens. And there's so many stories of like really bad things happening at these lighthouses. And this is one of them. And this is a famous one. So this island, Aylin Moor, has been shrouded in mystery well before the disappearance of the lighthouse keepers. The Flannan Isles are a set of 7 rocky islands northwest of Scotland, sometimes referred to as the Seven Huntsmen, and they have a long history of rituals and mysteries. Aylin Moor is Scottish Gaelic for large island. Because of this, there are a multitude of islands around this area named Aylin Moor, but this island specifically is where the Flannan Isles Lighthouse stands. This island for years was feared or treated with respect because of the supernatural nature of this place. The islands get their name from St. Flannan, which there are several St. Flannans, and there's not really a consensus on which one is which. Either way, one of the more widely agreed upon legends is of a guy named Flannan Mac Tordelbeg. And I probably said that wrong. I'm not really well versed in 7th century Gaelic, and his name is very interesting. I hope I said it right. That's the only time I'm going to say it. The rest of the time, I'm going to call him Saint Flannan. So in the 7th century, he built a chapel on the island along with some bothies.
Well, so what are bothies exactly?
They're basically like little sheds. I'm not sure if people lived in them, but they stored stuff in them. But they're really, really tiny structures that they built alongside the chapel. And when you think of a chapel, don't think of like the classic Southern Baptist like church building. It's 7th century stone structure, and now it's just like a big pile of rocks. So the ruins of these buildings are a reminder of a long history on this island. But the years leading up to the building of the lighthouse, many viewed this island with superstition. And because of that, there were many rituals associated with it, such as circling the church on your knees, uncovering one's head when landing on the island, or making a sunwise turn when reaching the plateau of the island.
These are some really weird superstitions.
Very weird superstitions. The circling the church on your knees is kind of a interesting sight. Just imagine guys up there on their knees just going in circles around that pile of rocks. For a period, shepherds would bring their sheep there to graze on the island. The legend goes that sheep that were injured or sick, they'd be healed by the grass on the island. The sheep herders would never stay after dark as they were afraid of the spirits that resided there, including a watchful presence that's said to have ill intent. A further quick note here, there's a ring of Genesis slabs similar to that of Stonehenge on the nearby island Aelin Shire that date back to 3000 BC. It's said that human sacrifices may have taken place here. Aelin Shire is one of the 7 islands in the Flannan Isles.
So you say it's a quick note, but I mean, that's a pretty big deal. Human sacrifices on the island next door.
It's a quick note because it's not the island that we're talking about. But yeah, it's it is interesting because there is a lot of history here. And the reason I mentioned that is because these islands for years and years have been regarded as like kind of mystical and have a place in Gaelic folklore. And so I had to bring that part up because this whole set of islands has some like mystery behind it. Those legends actually extend back before the monk Saint Flannan. And that's all Gaelic folklore. The inhabitants were said to be known as that of the, I don't know how to pronounce this either. I had a hard time finding this word. Whenever I looked it up, only the lighthouse stuff was coming up in reference to this word. So it's pretty unique. Los Berdane, I think is how you would pronounce it in Gaelic. These people were said to be that of small stature. And supposedly, there are the remains of these people on the island. Buried on this island are these little bones from the Los Berdane.
So what you're saying is this is where leprechauns come from.
The legend basically goes that these people were actually sprites or mischievous elves, like leprechauns or fairies, all of which come from Celtic folklore. Now, of course, we're starting to stray into some unfounded territory here talking about Celtic mythology. But just keep all this in mind, that this island has a long history of legends and folklore. And we'll come back to sprites, leprechauns, whatever you want to call them, at the end of the episode when we go through theories.
Dude, this is really exciting. I actually love Celtic mythology a little bit. I don't know a whole lot about it, but you've got my attention.
Well, I'll say it this way. This is a very exotic theory that we're going to get into later. And most articles or stories that regard the Flannan Isles Keeper's disappearance don't really even touch the Gaelic folklore. But I like drawing a big picture so that we can work our way back. It's at the very beginning and it's going to be at the very end. And I wanted to be part of it because these islands do have that folklore, but 99% chance, probably even more, 100% chance that these guys weren't disappeared by sprites or mischievous elves, but maybe.
It probably just involved a bunch of liquor.
Probably did. So leading up to the 1800s, many ships wrecked on the rocky shores of these islands, and oftentimes the bodies of their crews could be seen mangled on the rocky shores. Now, this was obviously a real problem, so it was decided that a lighthouse would be built on the big island to warn ships to steer clear. The lighthouse was finished in 1899 and first lit on December 7th, 1899, the date that will live in infamy.
All right, dumb that down for me.
Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
Now, lighthouses back then before automation required a live-in crew. As such, food and provisions for such a long time were required. There was a little railway that was built leading up to the lighthouse from the docking location at the base of the island, with a little steam engine that could carry provisions up to the lighthouse. These men were working an extremely remote job. If there was a problem, there were very few resources to get help. One of these resources was a man named Roderick McKenzie, who was paid to watch for anything weird or for communications. He was a gameskeeper on the neighboring island, Galen Head. The lighthouse keepers had this pole and disc that they could use to signal the gameskeeper in an event of an emergency. And we'll get back to that when we talk about the investigation portion of this episode. But they didn't have really any recourse to say there was something was going on. They literally just had a pole with a disc that they'd wave in front of the lighthouse. And a lot of times the weather was so bad or the fog was so thick that the gameskeeper would for days not be able to see the lighthouse in the distance because it was so far away.
I don't know how these guys did it. At the same time, I'm kind of thinking about if I did this, like how many books that I could read.
Yeah, just hunker down by candlelight reading books. I'd have a ton of time to write these episodes so we could just bust them out. Okay, so now it's 1900 and there are four lighthouse keepers. They were on a 6 week on, 2 weeks off rotation, so that there were only three keepers on the island at a time. There was James Ducat, the head keeper, second assistant Thomas Marshall, and occasional keeper Donald MacArthur. He was working for the first assistant keeper while he was out on sick leave. The fourth was Joseph Moore, who was on his 2 week off rotation when the disappearance occurred. According to Ducat's family, Ducat was hesitant to take the job at this specific lighthouse due to the history of these islands and the superstitions that surrounded them. So I'm also having a really hard time not slipping up and calling this guy Ducat. As I was going through this for the first time, all I could think of was Gul Dukat from Star Trek, and it was just invasive. Every time I saw his name, all I could see was Gul Dukat, and I'm like, these dang Cardassians showing up.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Yeah, I figured as much. Anyways, let's not spend too much time there, but if you hear me say Dukat, it's because I have a hard time not saying it, just based on that being in the back of my mind all the time. So the first signs of trouble come from the SS Arctur, traveling to Leith from Philadelphia. He has to divert his ship, as when he approaches the area, there's no light coming from the lighthouse. He docks in Leith and informs the port authorities to this irregularity, but nothing comes of it other than it being noted down.
Wow, I'm surprised they wouldn't send guys out to this, like knowing that that's not a normal thing.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, and I don't know if it was like they dropped the ball or if it was just kind of one of those situations where, yeah, we get it, the lighthouse doesn't, it can't always be seen, there's some bad weather here and there. I don't know how abnormal it was to not see the lighthouse, because when they go and they talk to the gameskeeper later, we'll talk about this in the investigation portion, they didn't seem like it was that weird that they would go days without seeing the light because it was so far away or the weather was bad. It was weird because they were sailing and they were really close to the island, so they should have seen it, but it is interesting that they didn't investigate it. So on December 26th, the lighthouse tender ship the Hesperus arrives at Aylin Moore with relief keeper Joseph Moore. They quickly notice there's no signal flag on the flagpole, and the normal custom was to greet the relief party as well as leave provision boxes at the landing site. None of this had been done, so they blare the horn and nothing. Captain James Harvey, he shoots off some flares. I think maybe just one flare, but multiple sources say he shoots off flares to hopefully get the attention of the crew, and still nothing. So it's decided that the relief keeper, Moore, should go ashore and investigate. He lands on the east landing site and climbs up the 160 steps of the lighthouse. So now the legend part of this was that as he climbed these steps, three large blackbirds perched on the lighthouse were looking down on him and cawing, watching as he climbed the steps. And when he lands at the top of the stairway, all three birds fly away.
Yeah, no, dude. I start seeing those three blackbirds and they're calling at me. I'm out. I turn around, start walking back. I'm running down them stairs.
Yeah, just all the way down the 160 steps. That's more legend. I think he doesn't ever say anything. I didn't read any of his stuff that said anything about three blackbirds, but it's part of the legend of like the three men were missing. There's three large blackbirds on the top of the lighthouse warning Joseph Moore, and they flew away. Kind of like that's like the legend you would tell like around a campfire. I included it because it's part of it. I don't think it actually happened, but it's part of like the legend of these guys being disappeared.
I want to believe it. I want to believe it happened.
Yeah, believe. So he gets to the lighthouse. He finds that the entrance gate, the first and second door, are all closed and secured. The first thing that he notices is that the clocks were all stopped and that it looked like the fireplace had been used regularly, but it had been out for several days. The dinner table was set for a meal. I saw somewhere else that it had like half eaten food, but I don't think that's real. I think that's also part of like legend, or like, you know how the Mary Celeste, there was that story, the fire still warm, the cigar still lit, the food still on the table. It's kind of like that legend that builds afterwards. Supposedly everything just like looked normal. The table was set as if they were going to eat dinner, but there wasn't actually food on the table, half eaten or whatever.
Interesting.
One of the things that's interesting too is that it was said that one of the chairs at the table was tipped over on its side, which I find kind of interesting. Like maybe someone jumped up from the table and it fell over. We can talk about that a little bit later during the investigation, but that's the only thing that's kind of like in disrepair, a chair that's on its side on the floor. He goes into the living quarters and he finds that all three beds have been left as if the occupants had gotten up to start their day as normal, which I don't know exactly what that meant. It was kind of funny because some articles were like the beds were neatly made and other ones were like they were all in disarray. But the way the investigator says it when he writes his official statement, he basically just says, the beds were left as if the occupants had gotten up to start the day as normal. That's how it reads. And if you want to read it as tucked in nicely or in disarray, read it however you want. But basically, the evidence that we have states the guys woke up and started their day as normal. They didn't disappear in the middle of the night, basically.
I guess it kind of makes sense to, it would be a big sign if like the beds were made or not made. At first I'm thinking, well, who cares if beds are made or not? But it does kind of make sense if the beds aren't made. Could be a sign that they had to jump up in the middle of the night. They didn't see. They knocked over the chair.
Yeah, exactly. It rules out something weird happening in the middle of the night and basically puts things back on track as, okay, something happened during the day. So the only sign of life was a canary in a cage. He also notices that of the three oil skins, which are basically like old school rain jackets, one is left inside, indicating that two men had worn theirs out and one had not. At this point, he's thinking something's wrong here, and he goes back to the ship to get help. So two more sailors join the search, and they just scour the whole island. They found that the logbook with the final entry of December 13th and a slate with entries from the 14th and 15th. If you remember from the Mary Celeste episode, we talked about how they had the logbook, and they also had the slate. So they would write stuff, like to take notes on the slate, and then they'd put everything in the logbook at the end. So typically what you had was a logbook with all the official stuff in it, and then a slate next to it with some notes on it. That's what we have here. The last official entry on the logbook is the 13th. And then on the slate, there was stuff from the 14th and the 15th. And so they had logged some information about bad weather. And what's really, really interesting about this, and I get hung up here, it's really weird because the sources elsewhere, like nearby islands, say there was no evidence of bad weather until the 15th. But in their logbook, they have like information about there being really bad weather on the 12th, on the 13th, leading up to their disappearance. But all the available evidence that we have says weather didn't get bad until the 15th, which is really weird.
Yeah, it is really strange. How far apart were these islands?
Far enough that it was kind of hard to see them. They're mostly just rocky shores, and they're on the biggest one. And then the other one that I know for sure that's inhabited is where the Gameskeeper is. And that one's far enough away that it wasn't uncommon to not be able to see the lighthouse for days at a time because it was so far.
You know, I guess I kind of asked that question as if there might be like different weather patterns, you know, just because of distance of how far apart they are. But obviously it shouldn't be that different, I wouldn't think.
It wouldn't be that different. And there's enough information at this time for them to have really bad weather on that island. From what I read, it would have to have been extremely, extremely isolated, like just over their island. So it was pretty unique that they had experienced bad weather, but nobody else had really seen that. The other thing really quickly I'll mention here is that on the 15th, they had an atmospheric reading at 9 a.m. And I think that might be the last entry on the slate. So the lamp of the lighthouse was oiled and fully prepped in working order. So one thing I want to point out is on the west landing, there's evidence of some really bad weather. The landing was really damaged. A wooden supply box that had mooring ropes, kind of tackles and stuff, it was missing, and the ropes were kind of just strewn about. The iron railings had been twisted and bent, and the railway track that had the steam engine for the provisions, there was pieces of it torn from the concrete. There was also signs that a one-ton boulder had been moved. The iron railing, the landing, and the supply box were all noted in the log, though, suggesting that it happened before the disappearance. So the railway and the boulder, those weren't in the logs.
Wow. That's some really good detail, though. It's kind of nice that they were able to write all this stuff down so that way we can kind of set up a timeline for what's going on.
Yeah. So it's funny because people will point to like the iron railing. Oh, the iron railing had a huge wave hit it. And that's what happened. But it's like, well, they wrote it down. And the tackle box, that whole supply box thing, it happened before they went missing. So another interesting piece of evidence was that of the missing life buoy. So it was about 100 feet above sea level, and the ropes that secured it had appeared to be torn, not cut, suggesting that they were not removed by the keepers and that something else caused the buoy to be pulled away from the railing, such as like bad weather or like a wave, a large wave that pulled it down 100 feet above sea level. So a few days later, Robert Murhead, the superintendent of the Northern Lighthouse Board, he arrives on the island for an official investigation. He notes the nervousness of Joseph Moore. He had been left with some sailors to keep the lamp lit and to find out whatever they could. And I want to focus in here a moment on the oilskins, essentially their raincoats. One of the three raincoats was left in the entrance hall.
So what would that mean?
It's really weird because those guys don't leave the lighthouse without the proper equipment. So for there all three of them to be missing, but only two coats to be missing instead of one, it's kind of a weird thing because they're required by the lighthouse board or whatever, the rules of their job is that one person is supposed to be in the lighthouse at all times. So two people left the lighthouse. They had their gear. They had their coats on. One person was still in the lighthouse. So if all three of them disappeared, why did one of them not wear a coat? Did one of them have a freak out panic attack and run out of the lighthouse and the other two chased after him? Did two of them leave with their coats on and the third person, something was amiss or awry and they ran out? Just think about that. Keep that in the back of your mind because the whole coat thing is really weird.
Yeah, or they needed somebody to stay at the lighthouse to keep the light running, and the other two wanted to go out and investigate.
Well, one person always had to be at the lighthouse. So yeah, if something was weird or going awry or amiss, two would put their gear on and leave. But the fact that one coat stayed and that third person is missing, that's what's really weird.
Yeah, it is weird. Aliens.
Yeah.
That's the thunderclouds.
Yeah, the thunder rolled over and the aliens came and pulled them out, like at Levland. So Robert Murhead, he's investigating the disappearance of the keepers. He speaks with Moore upon his arrival. And Moore had seen the keepers on December 7th before leaving them alone on the island. And I'm going to read a quick quote here from what he says to Murhead. So from an article I read on Strange Outdoors, quoting Joseph Moore, quote, "I have the melancholy recollection that I was the last person to shake hands with them and bid them adieu," end quote. So Moore is like super shaken up. And in Murhead's like official investigation statement, he actually talks about possibly shifting Moore to a different location, getting him off this lighthouse duty because he doesn't think that he should be here. But the problem is he's like really the only guy that's left that knows how to run it. So he's like, I got to keep him here. But he writes in his investigation that this guy is really shaken up and we might have to transfer him because he cannot handle being where all three of his guys he worked with have disappeared.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, three guys that you're living with day to day, you have to spend months with these guys. Like, you get close. I'm sure they turn into like family with you.
Yeah, exactly. You get really close with these guys and for all of them to disappear and for you to be the last person to talk to them or shake their hands and bid them adieu. That's got to be like a really jarring thing. Imagine saying bye to three people, they get in a car and immediately get in a car accident and they all die. Like, imagine being the last person all three of those people talk to. That's what this guy's going through.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Yeah. And so Murhead, he begins his investigation and he basically just corroborates everything that Joseph Moore found. And so a lot of what he even covers is pretty consistent with Moore, and he adds a little bit more color here, and his official investigation is all written out. So we'll talk about them a little bit more in depth here. The first thing I want to do is I want to read a portion of this. He's standing on the crane platform 70 feet above sea level because he can't go down to the west landing. Basically, the way he says it is owing to the amount of sea, which I guess just means higher than normal sea levels or a rough sea at the shore. By the way, he's standing on the crane platform 70 feet up. He can't get down to the west landing. To quote Murhead's official investigation, which you can find this in full on that same Strange Outdoors article I quoted before, and this will be in the show notes if you want to go look at it. That article just has his full investigation written out, so go and read that if you want. But let's read a quick quote here from that. So Murhead states, quote, "A life buoy was fastened to the railways along this path." He's referring to the path from the terminus to the tramway where that giant one-ton stone was moved to. "To be used in case of emergency, had disappeared. And I thought at first it had been removed for the purpose of being used, but on examination, the ropes by which it was fastened, I found they had not been touched. And as pieces of canvas was adhering to the ropes, it was evident that the force of the sea pouring through the railings, even at this great height, 110 feet above sea level, torn the life buoy off the ropes. When the accident occurred, Ducat was wearing sea boots and a waterproof, and Marshall, sea boots and oilskins. And as Moore assured me that the men only wore those articles when going down to the landings, they must have intended, when they left the station, either to go down to the landing or the proximity of it." End quote. So this implies here that two of the men who are wearing the appropriate clothing went down to the landing while they were there. There's evidence that a giant wave hit upwards of 110 feet above sea level and swept them away.
So, I mean, that sounds perfectly reasonable. I mean, I know these islands, like, you can have some really good waves hitting the sides. Of course, it's not reasonable that there's a huge storm that's so bad that apparently the islands around it don't see it, but just them.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is that there were storms, and the storms hit on the 15th, which is the day that they had gone missing. Leading up to that date is when they were writing in the logs how bad the storms were, but the storm actually hit on the 15th. So they had gone out maybe thinking the storms had cleared up, and all of a sudden the weather hit, like the swells hit.
Oh, wow.
But again, the problem with this is that if two men were dressed to go down to the landings, a giant wave came and crashed down on them and pulled them out to sea. What about the third guy? He was still at the lighthouse. How did he also disappear? If protocol said one guy was at the lighthouse, two could go and do whatever, and they were just doing their normal business. They had gone down to the landing, and they got hit by a wave. They were wearing the proper equipment and the clothing to go down there. One person stayed in the lighthouse. I don't see how this would imply that if they had gone down there and got swept away, the third guy, what happened to him?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if he, like, heard some screaming or something and ran out really quickly trying to run out and help and just didn't think about his oil skin.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that here in a bit during the investigation portion and bring that up later because that definitely comes up. But also the other part of that is, I guess maybe he's sitting at the table getting ready to eat dinner. The guys had gone out, he's waiting, and a giant wave hits the side of the lighthouse and he thinks, oh boy, they were out there. And then he runs out, and then he also gets hit by maybe a second wave or, like, bad weather. I don't know. We'll talk about that later because there's an actual, like, timeline. There's the theory details all that out, and I'm thinking about it right now, but I don't want to talk about it at this moment. Let's talk about it during the theory portion of this. So Murhead, he zeroes in on the logs, and there's some really weird things here in the logs. Thomas Marshall has an entry on the 12th, writing of severe weather, the likes of which he hadn't seen in 20 years. It apparently was so bad that William MacArthur had been so disturbed that he had been crying. And he also notes that Ducat had grown very quiet. Now, I want to point something out here at this point. We talked about the groundskeeper, Robert McKenzie, at Galen Head. He was supposed to be keeping watch for anything strange. Well, Murhead goes and knocks on his door. The gamekeeper, he's not there, but his two sons are. They let him in and he can read the return book, which has all the dates that he looked at the lighthouse or looked for the lighthouse. So he saw a light on the 12th and not again until the 26th when Moore relights it. In Murhead's investigation, he basically says it's not super uncommon to go days without seeing the light, as with the distance and the weather, it could be tough to see. He further notes that if it was a lighthouse keeper that noticed the light being out for that long, they probably would have reported it sooner. The fact that it was a gameskeeper, he didn't know much about it. He knew that it would go periods without being seen. He noted it in his logbook, but didn't actually report it. And so there's a brief period there where it's not, he doesn't see light. But then again, he doesn't see it from the 12th until the 26th.
I mean, I can't blame the guy. Unless they, like, give you a protocol. Hey, let us know if you don't see it for so many days. If they're just like, just keep an eye out for it. That's why there needs to be protocol.
Yeah. So he sees the light for the final time the day before the entry discussing the crying and the quietness of Ducat, but no bad weather. Now, remember the logbook has final entries on the 13th, but the slate has some from the 14th and 15th. So on the 12th, the day the light was last seen, the log states that the storm is still ravaging the island. Marshall writes in a log that all three men are hunkered down and praying, which they should be comfortable in their lighthouse. I mean, these men, they're well-weathered, they're light keepers, they should be comfortable or familiar with big storms, and they know that the lighthouse is safe, they shouldn't worry about it. But the logs basically state that they're hunkered down, they're praying, they're freaked out, one guy's crying, Duquette's really quiet, and the final entry in the log was, quote, "Storm ended, sea calm, God is over all."
You know, this kind of like makes me think of kind of like a scary movie. It almost comes up to like, it kind of reminds me of a movie where I saw where these people like went insane and then it got so bad that they kind of just leveled out. They done killed each other, or one of them killed all the rest, and they're just like, oh, everything's okay now. You know, like they did this really bad, evil thing and they're like, oh, everything's fixed.
That's kind of how this goes. It kind of comes up as these guys were hallucinating this big storm. They finally felt at peace, and the day they felt at peace, they kind of do their normal chores. The 15th comes around, they go out, and that's when the real storm hits and kills them. That's how this reads.
That's the way I see it going down too. Like, that's kind of what I think when I think, you know, one guy's crying in the corner, one guy's real quiet. You know, I'm wondering if maybe some kind of fumes, like some kind of fungus or something they ate, just made them like go crazy, and then all of a sudden it's good.
Yeah. Or the fairies or the sprites were punishing them and playing tricks on them.
Dun, 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 dun.
So the slate has some entries from the 14th and 15th. And on the 15th, the slate has like the usual chores. Trimming the lamp, filling the oil reservoir, cleaning the lenses, etc. All just the basic upkeep stuff. The final entries are basically, we've kept the lighthouse running, essentially.
Now, if that were true, the gamesmen should have seen this lighthouse, right?
Yeah, but what's interesting is that when they go and investigate, when Moore goes to the island, he sees that the lamp had been trimmed, the oil had been filled up, the lenses had been cleaned. Everything looks good. Like, they got everything set up, but then didn't light the lamp. That's how it's found. They do everything in the morning to get it ready for the next night, and they don't light it because something happened to them, essentially.
Interesting.
So at this point, we've discussed the timeline and the investigation. I think now it's time to move over to our theories. So first, let's talk about the weather. So we know that the weather from the outside perspective was that it hit on the 15th, which is the same day that these men went missing. There are records and precedent for massive waves hitting this island. It's been recorded that waves as high as 300 feet have hit this island.
Oh my gosh, dude, that is creepy.
And so this theory basically goes, two men, Duquette and Marshall, and the appropriate gear, they go down to the West Landing, the location of the landing or near it or whatever, and somehow one of the men end up in the water. One of the sources mentioned the missing tackle box, for example, being caught up in a wave or something, and somehow it falls from the landing, and when they're trying to get it, one of the men falls in. And this is a tad bit of a stretch, I think, because we talked about this earlier. The missing tackle box is in the log. So I don't see how like the tackle box falling in the water could be part of it. Unless they are like, they go back out to the landing and they see the tackle box on the rocks below. And somebody's like, oh, let's go down and grab it. Let's go get it. That's the only way I see that making sense, is the tackle box being washed back ashore, or them seeing it and deciding they're going to go get it. And the reason I say that is because it comes out of their paycheck when equipment goes missing. So if they knew that the tackle box had gotten damaged and they're like, all right, later when the weather dies down, let's go out and go pick up the tackle box. And they like made a plan to go do that. Maybe that's what was happening. But basically, somebody falls in the water when they're trying to retrieve the tackle box. And so now regulation states that at least one man had to be at their post in the lighthouse at all times. But if one of the guys had fallen in the ocean, maybe it's possible that the other would then run up to the lighthouse to alert the third person of the emergency. And that would explain the upset dining room table and the oil skin still hanging up in the lighthouse, because if you're leaving in a hurry and rush down to save someone, you might not grab the proper gear. While they're down there, the two men are trying to get the guy, the third guy, out of the water, and that's when this rogue wave comes in and washes everybody out to sea. So remember Murhead, he mentions the life buoy 110 feet up, looked as if it was torn from the rope. So if the two men are attempting to get the buoy, and all of a sudden this massive wave hits them and crashes down and pulls them out to sea, maybe that explains it. One person had fallen in, the second person went to get the third person out of the lighthouse. They both come down, and while they're trying to rescue the third guy, a giant wave comes in and pulls them all out to sea. So the timing of this also kind of makes sense, because to the outside observer, the weather did hit on the 15th, and we know that the 15th is when they most likely disappeared. So they could think, oh, wow, the weather's clear. Let's go outside. Let's get the tackle box. All of a sudden, the ocean swells, and a big wave crashes down and wipes them all out. That's the first theory.
Yeah, but I still kind of think it's kind of dawning about the last few days in the book. I mean, one man is crying because the storm is so bad, and one man is just not talking.
Yeah, that kind of like makes it weird that they're hallucinating, or they think that a storm's happening, or a storm is happening. But it could be that a storm was isolated to their island. It subsides. Those two guys go out. Finally, the weather's cleared. I'm going to go get the tackle box. He falls in the water, and then all this takes place. The weird thing about this, though, to poke a hole in this a little bit, I saw like some commentary somewhere where it talked about like, okay, so he's in a hurry. He leaves the lighthouse. He rushes out of the lighthouse, doesn't grab the coat, but he had the presence of mind to close the inside door, the outside door, and the gate to the entrance. So he's going to close all three doors but not grab his coat.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes so much sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, I should say. Like, let me take the time, hold on to close this door, but not let me grab my coat.
Yeah, he rushes out. He knows he's going to be fishing somebody out of the water, doesn't grab his coat, but closes all the doors behind him. So I don't know. That's the first theory. That's the one that most people hang their hats on. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. When we go through our portions, I think I'm going to pull from that a little bit. That's the first theory. So the next theory is that we have some kind of foul play. So we know that in the logs, it was written down that Ducat had grown quiet, and also that MacArthur had been crying. So according to outside sources, the weather didn't really, you know, get bad until the 15th, but Marshall entered into the log on the 12th, the severity of the weather and the overall air of dismay these men were feeling. So this is really only speculation, because there's not really any evidence to these guys killing one another. Some have suggested that one of the men finally just snaps at some point, either killing the others before throwing himself off the rocks into the sea, or even one man kind of losing his resolve and fleeing the lighthouse. The other two, they grab their oilskins and they chase after him, and they get caught up in a storm or something. So remember, the investigation honed in on the two more seasoned men, Ducat and Marshall, having been wearing the gear outside of the lighthouse. So they know, based on the gear that was worn, that Ducat and Marshall were the two guys that were outside the lighthouse, and MacArthur was the one who didn't wear his gear. So could MacArthur have finally snapped? He was the occasional keeper. Maybe it was just too much for him. He snaps and he rushes out of the lighthouse into the bad weather, and then something happens and these two guys then grab their coats and chase after him.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting theory, but I would think that these guys would be trained on how to pick up on your teammate getting to that point.
I don't know. This is, you know, a long time ago. This is 1900. Mental health wasn't as big of a thing. I mean, World War One was still, what, 1914 to 1921? And even then they called it shell shock, right? Like, the mental health was still very far away from things they actually paid attention to. And if one of these guys goes insane, yeah, maybe there's some signs, but they're probably not really well equipped to handle somebody losing their mind, right?
Yeah, that makes sense too. Yeah, you're right. It does kind of sound like, I mean, it's a possibility that the weather's just so bad that, you know, one of them finally just loses their marbles and just decides to run for it.
Yeah, and the weird thing is that they're talking about how bad the weather is, but the weather supposedly wasn't even happening at this point. So were they hallucinating this big storm? Or one person was so far gone that he just sprinted out? I kind of think of like World War One, like shell shock or like PTSD. And I think about like the books All Quiet on the Western Front, or even like Goodbye to All That, where they talk about these guys just getting to the point where they were being shelled for so long that they were just so far gone that they were like wild animals, where they would run out of the bunkers up on the land where all these shells are coming in, because they had just, they couldn't take it anymore. And so it makes me wonder if, like, MacArthur, he's one of those guys. The shells are coming in, he's hunkered down, and it gets to a point where it makes more sense for him to just run than stay hunkered down any longer. And then Ducat and Marshall, they still have the reserve, they're seasoned keepers, they get their stuff, they chase after them, and then it all falls apart.
And that makes a lot of sense. That's one really good theory. Kind of back to your putting a hole in it, though. Why would they shut all the doors?
Yeah, I come back to that a lot. It's like, if it was such a bad situation where everyone was just like taken off, why are the doors closed? Oh, we're leaving. Let's lock up. Like, what? Why would that happen? One other thing I do want to mention before we kind of get into our exotic theories. Some people suggest that the logs that describe MacArthur crying and Ducat growing quiet as like illegitimate and not actually part of the real original logs. I don't think there's really any way of knowing. People poke holes in it and they say that you wouldn't normally put that kind of information in the logs. I don't know enough here, but some people say that they think that maybe these logs aren't real and they're part of a bigger story, which would kind of basically poke the hole in all of the discrepancies. I don't know how you say these logs are fake or real. At this point, there's no real way of knowing, but I have heard some say, or at least suggest, that these additional logs where they talk about them losing their minds have been tacked on to make the story a bigger legend than what it actually is.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense that you wouldn't put in like an official document why your teammates are crying. And I'm pretty sure your teammates would not say, yeah, let's go ahead and leave that in the log, that I was up in the corner bawling my eyes out.
It could just be such a bad situation that he kind of breaks tradition and Marshall's like, I got to write this stuff down. This is bad. I got to make a note of this. Could be that.
That's true too. But once again, if your teammates see that, they probably just killed him for it.
Ducat grew quiet and he's writing down the notes like, this guy's going crazy. And like, he's over his shoulder, what are you writing, Marshall? Okay, so let's get into some exotic theories here.
Aliens. The Thunder. I mean, you know, you got two guys. They got taken by a wave. Gone. The other guy is staying, taking care of the lighthouse, abducted by aliens.
The aliens have come in. I think every unsolved mystery, you have to include aliens, because it's like, we don't really know what happened. So our podcast does cover UFOs, so why not just say, hey, aliens might have taken them. There's no evidence of that, but there's also no evidence of these guys going crazy and killing each other. So you got to give weight to it. The actual theories that I do have are a little bit more honed in. So I don't have anything here for the aliens, but let's talk about some folklore stuff. So at the beginning of the show, we talked about the folklore that existed around this island. There's some theories that extend to the spirit of St. Flannan. Kind of, he comes back and he wreaks havoc on the keepers who disrespected his island by not respecting the odd traditions or the customs. One thing I think that was really interesting when I was reading, I didn't see this explicitly talked about anywhere, but I was reading about St. Flannan, and St. Flannan's feast day is December 18th. Did he wake up a little early and take his revenge on the keepers on the 15th?
Yeah, he's like, huh, where's my food at? I guess I'm eating these three guys.
Yeah, I thought that was really weird that it doesn't really get talked about, but his feast day is the 18th. And all this stuff happened mid-December 15th, and then they didn't get discovered till the 26th. But this theory basically says that the ghost of St. Flannan, he comes back. He's upset that they built a lighthouse here next to his chapel, and he kills them, makes them go crazy, whatever. And he's responsible for their disappearance.
And then he locked the lighthouse up.
Yeah, then he closed all the doors. I made sure everything was good. He ate their dinner that was left on the table and then went back to sleep.
It was so rude to leave him the chair knocked over, though.
Yeah, he got up from the table and knocked the chair over. So that's the first exotic theory. There's not a lot to it, but, you know, that's one of them. St. Flannan showed back up and he killed these keepers. My last theory here, it's another exotic theory. We talked about the history early on. We have the bookends. The very beginning, we talked about the old folklore that comes from here. The final theory is the folklore of Aelin Mor, their oldest inhabitants. This, of course, is way out there, but it's similar to St. Flannan in that What if the spirits of these old inhabitants, they come back and they wreak havoc on the keepers? They play tricks on them, they drive them insane, or they kill them. So if you think about like World War II and like gremlins, they always talk about like gremlins that wreak havoc on the plains, things like that. What if these little creatures, these little spirits, whatever they were, that lived on this island thousands of years ago, they're still here on this island. And they're also upset that this lighthouse has been built. And they play tricks on these keepers. They cause the keepers to leave or go insane. A couple of them to leave with their coats on, one to rush out thinking something's wrong. And they get them in a precarious position and a wave comes in and wipes them out. What if those little inhabitants, those little leprechauns, caused the death of these keepers?
Or it was a combination of both.
Yeah, or it was everything. It was all this stuff put together. One more comment I want to make is, remember at the beginning, the legend of the three blackbirds?
Yeah.
So the legend part of this is that each one of those birds is a keeper, that his soul or whatever was turned into a blackbird. And they're all perched on the lighthouse and they're calling down at Moore, basically telling him, don't approach, don't come up to the lighthouse. And when he finally does, their spirits fly away, basically. And he then has to figure out what happened. That's kind of like a legend portion of this. Like, their spirits became these three blackbirds that were calling down at Moore, saying, don't come up here.
Yeah, man, that is so creepy. Hairs in my arms are standing up.
Yeah, it's a creepy thought. That whole thought is very weird and creepy. Again, that's probably the most woo-woo portion of this. More than likely, these guys just got washed away by a wave. But it is interesting to like add all the mysticism behind this, because when you talk about a mystery and we don't really know what happened, the most logical explanation is probably true. But when you add in all the folklore and the mysteriousness of this island, the fact that people have thought spirits have lived there for years and years, maybe there's more to it. There's a supernatural element to this story, maybe.
Yeah, so when you think about it, I honestly don't think the insanity theory is too much of a stretch. Because, you know, you have cabin fever. I mean, it's a real thing. People locked up in a house for months on end. Stuff happens, man.
They lose their minds. Yeah. So now it's part of the show where we talk about our own thoughts, our own theories, our own opinions. And I'll go ahead and go first. You know, I think maybe it's a combination of bad weather and maybe the insanity thing. They were locked up for so long. They were freaked out by the storms. And maybe they kind of lost their resolve. I think that a big wave washed them away. The reason they were out there, I don't know. Part of me thinks like, yeah, the cabin fever thing, the fact that they may have lost their resolve, that they were hunkered down for so long that they kind of like weren't thinking right. They weren't thinking correctly. And they finally get outside because things seem to have cleared up and they got caught by a giant wave because the weather finally cleared and they were like, oh, finally. And then they get hit by this wave. That's my thought. That maybe it's part of like them going insane a little bit, like losing their resolve. That's where I land. It has to be something like that.
Yeah, so I kind of have two theories that are kind of going on track with what we've talked about. But one thing I don't think we talked about was like the fumes that they have to use for lighting the lighthouse. Could those cause hallucinations? Like, I wonder if maybe those like caused hallucinations, and hallucinating plus the storms like made them go insane.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, maybe it's possible, but a lot of other lighthouse guys have gone crazy. So maybe the fumes had played a role in it. Maybe like lead paint, how we painted everything with lead paint for years and years and years, and we finally outlawed it in like 78. Maybe the fumes could have played a role.
Yeah, I mean, so that's one theory that I think is a pretty good theory, in my opinion. This is kind of a stretch, maybe a little bit, of, you know, say those two guys that took the oil coats out, or the oil skins, they take them out, they're going to fix something, they die, and the last guy, you know, either sees it happen or knows it happens and then continues to take care of the lighthouse, but then he just gets depressed, you know, like...
kills himself or something.
Yep, that's what I'm thinking. Like, he's just like, all right, I can't do this. I can't go on. And so he just locks up the gate, sets everything up, and just goes out and ends it.
Yeah. He sees them get swept away, and then he's all by himself, and he's like, yeah, I'm done. Locks everything up, makes sure everything's good to go, and then he just jumps into the ocean.
or their spirits start haunting them.
Yeah, or that. Who knows? Who knows? Well, thank you all for tuning in to another episode of our show, The Anecdotalist. We love doing this. We have a blast making these episodes. And as promised, after the theme plays here, there's going to be some bonus content discussing my visit to the Ohio State Reformatory. So stick around for that. But thanks again to all our listeners, and join us next week for another ghost story. Okay, so we're in bonus content land. Never done this before. I guess we could be a little bit more casual with how we're having this conversation. So if, Jason, you're curious about it, you have any questions? I know I was texting you while I was there taking some pictures. What'd you think?
Oh my gosh, man. So the first picture of the chair that we talked about, that was creepy. I was kind of halfway expecting, like, you know how you look at a photo and like you find out later that you took a picture of a ghost or something?
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I was like zooming in on the picture, like trying to see if I could find like any like ghost figures or something. Like, I thought for sure there'd be something in the picture, just like, you know, something that you might have missed, like looking at it, you know? So it really is creepy though. I mean, the paint is obviously peeling from the walls. Even for a joke, I'm not sure if I could go in this room, sit in that chair, and turn the lights out. I mean, just from the picture itself, I feel like it kind of has an evil kind of feel to it.
Well, there was a single light bulb above that chair, and it was like barely illuminating the room, and then nothing else but that chair in that room. And it was a hot attraction. It was funny because the whole place is very heavy Shawshank Redemption themed. There's so much stuff. Every room that there was even an actor that stepped foot in, they had it set up in a way where you could see like props and different things and stuff written down about each room and how they shot the movie and stuff. But there were little pieces of scary stuff like that chair room that was unique away from the Shawshank Redemption stuff. And there was some interest. It was really funny because there was a guy, and I think his mom, which is funny because I was there with my dad, but he was talking about how he moved the chair to the other side of the room and left. And then they walked back in to see if it had moved back, just like messing with it. Right. And we talked about how that one person who messed with the chair, sat down in it, had the scratches on their back. I didn't have any scary things happen. I was like kind of hoping for something. And like you were saying, looking through the pictures, I looked through every single picture hoping to find something like, oh, look, there's eyes over here or something like that. I didn't, but it was a blast. We had a great time. And the fun thing is that my dad and I, huge Shawshank Redemption. I watched that movie a ton of times when I was younger, read the book, the novella by Stephen King. And so getting to walk through where they filmed the movie was amazing. But then also the timing was so awesome because we were walking through rooms and I knew things that it seemed like nobody else was talking about. One of them, and we'll have the picture on our website. I posted them on Instagram if you follow us. One of those pictures was of that Helen Glatke memorial card with a little rose in it. It was in a closet. So the closet that she knocked the gun off the shelf and it shot and killed her, that closet, they're renovating that room. And they had a bunch of crap just jammed into this closet. Boxes, random stuff. It was real dusty. And I was walking through and I thought, I wonder where the closet is where this happened. And I poked my head and I saw that little plaque. It was like a little tiny 4x6 card with her name on it and a little memorial thing and a flower, like a rose in a little vase. And no one else was even looking at it. And I was like, Dad, look at this. This was, and I explained the story to him. And I didn't see where anybody even really realized what that was. And it felt very intimate in that moment, knowing someone had been shot there, had died there, and there was a little memorial plaque for her, knowing that they're remodeling that space and it's kind of been pushed to the side. And I was able to walk in and feel like I was a part of history that we talked about on the podcast and explain it to my dad, who was like, oh, that's really cool. And no one else had like really been aware, because everything else is so focused on Shawshank. And then in that room specifically, it's all been torn up to renovate it, basically.
Yeah, I remember when you sent me this picture too, because I was like kind of astonished that I'm also kind of surprised that they don't kind of put that more out for display, just to kind of talk about the haunted stuff that's happened there. I'm kind of surprised that it was kind of stuffed in a closet.
Maybe they do. I don't know. Well, what's interesting is that we did a self-guided tour. If you had a tour guide, maybe they would talk more about it. One thing I noticed as well was there is something called Beyond the Bars. I think that's what it was called. Basically, they do like night tours, like haunted tours, and you go to the prison and you get like a deep dive into like the ghost stuff and deeper into the prison. And I imagine when you do tours like that, you get that information. I didn't hear anything on the audio guide, the self-guided portion, but I didn't listen to all of them either. We walked through and we talked about different things, but it was fun. What I will say is there was a police officer, a Mansfield police officer, that had an office on the first floor, and we poked our heads in, didn't realize he was there like basically running security. And we're like, oh, sorry, didn't mean to bump into you. And he's like, oh, no, no big deal. Come on in. So we went in there and we were able to talk to him, and he's worked with Shawshank and the Mansfield prison, all that for years and years and years. So he was able to tell us some stuff that he had known. And he brought up Helen Glatke and her death. And he kind of made this like, oh, they say the gun went off. Kind of like, guess what? Maybe this was actually her husband, Glatke, who shot her. Also, if you're listening to me say Glatke, that's how it's pronounced. Our episode that we did, I kept calling them Glat. It's actually Glatke. And when I heard that audio clip play for the first time when I was there, I was like, ah, dang it. Definitely mispronounced that.
So now you can't pronounce a town in Texas, and so now you can't pronounce the last names.
No, yeah. And you heard me butcher the Celtic Gaelic pronunciations earlier when we did this episode tonight.
That's all right. Hopefully we don't get too many haters on this.
Yeah, I mean, if we get hate mail, we're doing this for fun. This is us having a blast talking about some cool stuff. And I never expected to be perfect. I try my best to be as accurate as possible and get as much content as possible in these episodes, but there's no way to be perfect. I don't know how, unless we have like a whole team. And even when you have a whole team behind you that vets everything you're doing and you have a big production, all that stuff, you still have problems. For us, it's just, you know, two friends. We grew up together. Jason lives in South Carolina. I live here in Ohio. And we're just having a blast making episodes and talking about some scary stuff, some spooky stuff. Of course, our unsolved mysteries, all this. It's been really fun.
Oh, yeah. So back to the reformatory. Did the security guard offer up any other scary stories?
We spent most of our time talking about Shawshank. Again, this whole thing is overshadowed by Shawshank because they filmed such a successful movie there. He brought up to us that he worked as a police officer during the filming. And one thing I didn't know that's kind of interesting, if you've never done research or looked into the Ohio State Reformatory, the back portion of the reformatory, they tore it all down. They tore the yard's no longer there. A lot of the old buildings are no longer there. It's just the main section, the main building, and then the six-story cell block. There's a real prison, a new prison that's been built on the backside of the reformatory. So from the windows of the reformatory, you can see into the yard of a real prison that's active. And there's signs up on those windows that it's illegal to take pictures of that prison, because you can't take pictures of an active prison, I guess. And so he was talking about how at the time, they had a pretty heavy police presence on the grounds. And he was talking about how they tore stuff down, how they built a new prison. He has some information about that. Nothing really that applies or would align with what we're talking about tonight. But he had a lot of interesting insight of just like Mansfield itself and the new prison that's been built there.
Wow, that's so interesting. So when you were there, how did you feel like there was any evil presence?
You know, what's funny is I don't know if it was the heights, but when you're in the, because you get to walk down the cell block, you get to go, and I had pictures of that, and I stepped into some cells and stuff and just kind of felt that out. the height of it all and it being like basically steel frames that you're looking down through, that kind of adds a level of heightened anxiety, I think. And so you kind of feel on edge a little bit the whole time you're standing and walking through that little area. I will say when we walked through the solitary confinement area, that was probably the spookiest because it was pretty dark down there and they only had certain lights on during that. And then knowing the story of how they had shoved 6 people per cell and then one guy got killed and jammed under the bed, looking into those cells and standing there thinking 6 men were basically shoved into each one of these, that was pretty like jarring. And there was a sense of like, I don't know, I had a feeling of like dread when I was down there, but I wouldn't attribute it to anything paranormal. But it was, I imagine if you go there at night and do an actual like paranormal hunt or whatever, you would feel it. The whole prison itself was just in such disrepair. They're slowly working through it and renovating as much as they can. But so many rooms had just like peeling paint. And then if you ever watched the movie Shawshank Redemption and you see rooms where the paint is kind of in disrepair and chipping and peeling, that's all real because that prison was in such disrepair. And that's why they closed it in the first place. And there's still a lot of that. So every room you walk into, there were rooms that were off to the side with just piles of dirt and debris and stuff just kind of jammed in there. And there were sections that my dad and I were joking as we walked in, we're like, man, this is really disrepair. Like there was bathrooms where the toilet bowls were smashed or like the sink was broken in half. And it was really kind of sad, but also that added an element of this place has seen a lot of history and a lot of time. Time has worn down this prison.
Yeah, that kind of makes me like happy that they didn't just go and like repair stuff. They kind of keep it, you know, I know it's in disrepair, but it's kind of nice that they keep it that way to like say, hey, we're not messing with the history here. The history is here and it'll be here till it turns to dust, you know?
Yeah. And the place has some good bones, and I imagine it seems like over time they're going to try to their best to repair things. But yeah, it was a great time. One thing I also learned, it was kind of funny. My dad and I walked into this room, which I think they had. It's used now for events, like a kind of a ballroom style, and had a stage. But at the time, I'm not sure what they used the entire room for, but a portion of it was called the cage, where 2 security guards would stay throughout just all the time and basically control most of the prison from this area. And we're standing there and I look up and I kid you not, probably like 10 feet wide by 30 feet tall are these massive portraits of Stalin and Lenin on the walls. And we're like, what is this? They filmed a bunch of other stuff. They're not just Shawshank Redemption. And so it's just funny seeing, cause they kept up everything, the sets of things that they recorded in the past. The Go DJ, because that's my DJ, by Lil Wayne, that song Go DJ, that was filmed in 2004. They filmed it at the Ohio State Reformatory as well. And his cell that was painted gold for the music video, that's still there too on the West Wing. And so it was kind of fun like bumping into these little snippets of like Hollywood or things that we didn't know were there, because they left them. But the Lenin and Stalin on the walls were hilarious because we walked into this room and we're like, what is going on? Why does it feel like we're in the Soviet Union right now?
Dang, that's crazy. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it was really fun. And for everybody listening, jump on our website, jump on Instagram. We'll throw the pictures up there. You'll see some pictures of, I think I took pictures of the library. I took several of the cells, the 6-story cells. And then, of course, I had some of different rooms and just different things in there. We'll have them labeled, but it was a blast. It was really fun. And getting to do that with my dad was really cool because, you know, I watched that movie when I was a kid and getting to see all that stuff. And then also explain to him things in each room that were different that he wouldn't have known otherwise.
Well, your dad's really big into history, too, isn't he?
Yeah. And he had a blast walking through. We read probably every sign they had. Listen to almost all the audio clips and just had an overall fun time, a blast.
Yeah, man, I wish I could have been there, man. It sounded like it was so much fun. And I just remember like talking to you afterwards. And I mean, you sounded like you had a really good time and the pictures are really cool. I hate that. Like we talked about that whole thing and you got to experience it. I wish I really could have experienced it with you, man. I was like, it would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it would have been a blast to have you up there with me and go walk through those rooms, because I'm only one person. I can only remember so many things. But walking through, it's like, well, I don't even know how to explain it. Walking through an episode, it felt like I was walking through an episode that we recorded. It'd be like if we had gone to Rendlesham Forest, or if we had gone to Alcatraz, or one of these other places that we talked about. When you actually go there, it puts the episode in perspective, and it brings things to life that to you maybe didn't seem that big of a deal, like for me when I was doing the research, but it felt like a big deal when I was walking through the reformatory. So thank you for listening to our first ever bonus content. I don't even know what we call it. Beyond the bars, maybe. I don't know. But it was, we appreciate it. If you stuck around and listened to our bonus stuff, thank you. I guess people put this normally on Patreon. We're just sticking it at the end of an episode. So thanks for sticking around, giving it a listen. Tune in next week for a ghost story.